I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. State of the Union time from oblique angles in various accents this hour. Here's the Donald Trump version this week.
This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream.
And this was Franklin Roosevelt in 1940.
We cannot afford to face the future as a disunited people.
Ours, this hour, is a State of the Union by other means, in the candor of strangers, in a great reporter's memoir of war and Washington, also a biographer's sketch of the indomitable FDR in the Depression and World War. First is our subway sample. The Red Line under Boston is the melting pot in all its glory. Vietnamese in Fields Corner are 9 stops from MIT, 11 from Harvard. African Americans on a Red Line spur into Mattapan feel much further away in their fortunes. The jewel on the line, Kendall Station in Cambridge, next to MIT and the Charles River, centers a world capital in biomedicine, and it sounds the part. Our question was, your State of the Union, please.
Oh, I'm a biology professor at MIT. I think the State of the Union is in a very delicate situation because as far as the economy and jobs and things, especially here in Massachusetts, we're doing pretty well. I'm not very optimistic about the president, and several of his things make me nervous and make us nervous about our position in the world. And that affects me here as an MIT professor with international students and fellows wanting to come here. Being embarrassed of our president is not a good thing for that, and not making them comfortable. I've had immigrant students, Puerto Rican students, and transgender students, all of whom have been made quite uncomfortable. And so that's been a negative impact on my life as well.
So I live in Charlestown, Massachusetts, and I'm the CEO of a biotech company. The State of the Union is mixed. I generally am a hopeful person, and my daily interactions are with people that are trying to do good things in this world, especially if you're here in Boston and Cambridge. Unfortunately, when you watch the news, you see what's going on in our country more broadly from a Washington perspective, it's discouraging. So I think there's this fundamental disconnect between local environments like Boston and Cambridge, and I imagine this is true for other cities where people feel like their day-to-day interactions are very positive. But then we, when we scale that to a country, that we have some major fundamental issues. I think that's sort of the state of affairs from my perspective of where I see we are. I'm hoping that we can take local and make that more expansive and take local and make that more national, and that we all feel like we're all swimming or rowing in the same direction.
I drove down from Vermont this morning for an interview, but I go to Middlebury College in Middlebury, Vermont.
I would say the State of the Union is fractured. I am not a fan of where our country is going. I am a fan, though. I think what's neat is the way that people are responding. I think that it's inspiring when you think about the women that are stepping up, the women that are leading, but also people standing up for Black Lives Matter, different organizations. And I think that people are starting to realize that intersectionality is something that's becoming really important, and that we have to bridge gender divides. We also have to bridge racial divides as well in order to grapple with and come on top of the white male president that's currently there, for lack of a better word.
By the time you get to Mattapan, it's another state of another union.
State of the Union? I don't know. I don't know. Money? Jobs? Who's the State of the Union? Gangs? No one's doing anything about those things. And you know what? It's not all just about Trump. Trump is ridiculous, yes. But you know, the Democrats, the Republicans, all of them. They all need to be fired and look for new people. Because nothing's happening. Nothing's happening for the minorities. Nothing has been happening for the longest time. They do a few little things for us, and we think that's awesome. The court system, mandatory sentencing, they keep talking about it, but nobody does anything. You know, now that the drug situation has gotten so bad with the fentanyl and all that, you know what? When people of color was using crack, there wasn't all this, oh, it's a problem with their mental health. No, they were all put in jails. Homes were broken up. Families were torn apart. And no one did anything. No one cared. Now we're doing all of this stuff. And the community is still not healthy. We're still not back together. We're still struggling.
We feel left out.
Out of what?
Out of the loop of financial well-being, like comfortability. That's what we're feeling left out on. And again, this is not me personally, but I'm speaking of my client, my cousin, the person I hear at the grocery store, you know, all just overall, you know.
And they're saying, Sam?
Watch out for gentrification. Do what you can now to make as much money as you can get. You know, be aware. Don't close your eyes. You know, what's next? Am I still going to be here in the next 5 years in Boston? You know, I just spoke to someone last night. She made a little less than $30,000. She was trying not to go to one of the further places.
Brockton, Randolph.
One of those. But it came up. My point is, it came up. If Trump heard her speak, he would know how she felt.
Which is squeezed?
Scared, squeezed. Fear of not being able to make it, or a fear of having to accept something because you don't have control over it. Yeah.
Everybody I know have two jobs at least, some three. Families is just struggling to look for jobs. The jobs that we're receiving is not paying us enough. So we gotta, stay in homes where it's multiple families living in one home. And, it causes friction and arguments and, families break down. And it just causes chaos for us. You know, it's hard to maintain steady mind, steady flow when you're worrying about bills and stuff. It's hard to take care of your family and your kids, helping with homework and stuff when you have to work 2-3 jobs. It's a struggle. America will never be great if it continues like this.
Make a suggestion.
I don't know. What? Civil war?
Where do you begin?
I would say first step is you get a bunch of folks that never been in Mattapan to come out here and break bread with us, eat some plates with us, and invite us to come to your home and see what your lifestyle is about.
Because love is understanding. Love is all understanding. Exactly. Once you understand somebody, you begin to love that person. You love it. So it's all about loving and understanding.
Real estate prices are going up. Rent or houses themselves. How does this happen?
How does this happen?
In a poor community.
Because there's a plan, like there's always been a plan. There's been a plan since they brought slaves here. They had plans to make this place a better place so they'll be more accessible to jobs and the jobs they're creating. So they're going to come and build up the area and move you out.
All the big businesses are all coming into the city now. We got talking about Amazon, GE's in South Boston. So they getting all the tax breaks. And who's paying the price? The regular working people, man. That's what's going on.
Who's going to make Mattapan great again? What is the State of the Union here?
Whoever's in charge, they don't really like pay too much mind down here, really.
Cause like, if you're
they don't
poor,
really care.
No, the system is like made like that. If you're poor, like there's not gonna be a lot of people getting out of the poor.
Yeah.
If you're rich, you're taking from the poor, little by little. Yeah. And it's always gonna be like that unless someone actually changes it.
Thank you. What's the State of the Union in Mattapan?
State of the Union in Mattapan is that you're tweeting like you're two. You're just not acting normal. But, hey, what is normal? Look at the bigger picture. It's not about you. Yeah. It's about everybody else running around. Everybody's trying to get that piece of that apple pie that you keep telling us to get. You know what I'm saying?
Thank you.
Enjoy.
The Blue Line subway under the harbor to East Boston is the way to the airport, but first to Maverick Square, forever a sort of Boston version of Ellis Island in New York Harbor. What's missing in Trump time is an air of welcome.
They told me and my family, we are a working family. We live here. I'm an immigrant. I'm from Mexico. And I've been here 17 years, legal. And, you know, I'm working. My kid's born here. Everybody is here for something. And not everybody is like, come to this country to do bad things. You know, I think they come for opportunity. Maybe they see it in a different way. You know, he's not realistic at all.
Is this your child?
Yes, it's my daughter.
What's the state of your union?
I guess at this point, I see all the things that are going on with Trump and how he's running this country, and I feel like it's going to oblivion. Basically, we're not even doing what America is supposed to stand for, to unite people and to make people stronger and to actually support one another. But what Trump's doing, he's just separating everybody, and he's not uniting our country. We're supposed to be the United States of America. We've never been more separated in our history.
What's the state of East Boston?
The state of East Boston, I feel that we're still staying strong as our community, and we're making sure that we prosper, even if it doesn't have to do with our president, because we want to prosper ourselves. It doesn't matter if he's changing everything. We're still going to fight for our own rights.
I am from El Salvador, and I am a student from East Boston High School. Not all immigrants are bad. Some immigrants come for make their future and their family future different.
If you were in Salvador again, would you want to go to the United States after what you experienced?
No.
What would you do?
Stay in El Salvador.
And what was the disappointment or the bad surprise here?
It's not a bad surprise. It's because when you come, you suffer a lot. You don't have food to eat, and then you feel like scared. So that is the problem. He stereotyped all the people, and not all the immigrants are criminals.
Coming up with the biographer Robert Dalek, a touch of FDR for courage. This is Open Source. Vanessa Williamson has been our social scientist in the trenches since her first listening engagement with the Tea Party when it was a people's protest in Obama time. She's immersed now in the counterpart resistance on the left in Trump time, particularly workers and immigrants trying to organize in Texas.
To me, I think the State of the Union is really quite worrying. And in some ways, I think what we're seeing is just a continuation or an intensification, I should say, of problems that we've faced for a long time. Problems of inequality, problems of fears of new Americans, fears of immigrants moving to this country that I think have intensified. That not this is new to our history, but I think the last few years we've seen a real uptick in fears, particularly among conservatives, of new folks coming to this country, despite the fact that we are a nation of immigrants. We're really at a breaking point. We have a choice whether we're going to address these problems that distort and, I think, endanger our democracy, or continue to watch our political institutions erode.
That's what we get on the street. I mean, the things that come up without any leading of the witnesses are exclusion, immigration rights, and entrenched inequality.
Yeah, you know, a recurring finding in my research is that when you talk to regular Americans, they have smart things to say. You know, it's shocking how often that does not translate to our political process or to the media we consume. And I think it says a lot more about our political institutions and our media institutions than the actual hearts and minds of my fellow citizens.
Vanessa, in the subway crowd in Boston, what I hear, surprisingly a little bit, is toughness, humor, resilience, almost Emersonian self-reliance. They're ready, but I don't know about organization.
I could not agree with you more. I mean, and that, I think, is one of the real concerns that I have as a political scientist about how democracy is functioning in America. I think that, you know, many people have really sharp things to say about politics. You know, they follow the news and they have interesting, insightful remarks. And I think often when you talk to someone at some length, you find that their views are more nuanced and more interesting than the sort of soundbite you'd get if you didn't take the time. But at the same time, I think that for a lot of Americans, the experience of organizing is new. And that didn't used to be the case. Once upon a time, we had these enormous organizations, things like the Elks Club and the Rotary, and just lots and lots of organizations of that type that held local meetings and that had a federated structure, so you could be involved at the local level, and if people thought you were a pretty good speaker, you might go to the state convention for a particular organization, say the VFW, Veterans of Foreign Wars, what have you. At the state level, you might come up to the national level. These mass membership organizations gave people what Tocqueville called education in the workings of democracy. And I think that now, all too often, the experience of political engagement that people have, even people who are politically engaged, which is already not that many people, you know, it's getting emails and clicking and signing a petition or showing up to one protest or showing up to many protests, but it's not building the ties between people that allow for sustained organizing and that teach you democratic skills, like how to persuade someone, how to hold a meeting.
I sense that from people on the street, that they realize that the power in the country feels it could run the whole place without them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, there's this strong sense, and I don't think it's wrong in really fundamental ways, that the government doesn't currently operate with the best interests of most people in mind.
Certainly not of all people together.
Certainly not of all people, yeah. You don't have to look at a tax bill long to recognize what a tremendously small number of people will see the real benefits. And that's the only piece of legislation of any moment that was passed in an entire year. And so I think that people are quite aware of the ways in which their government is sometimes, at least, still uses the language of accountability and being a public servant, and then sort of acts with something approaching impunity.
Vanessa Williamson's latest book is titled Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. Here's a fuller fragment of Franklin Roosevelt's State of the Union from 1940.
Those selfish and partisan groups at home who wrap themselves in a false mantle of Americanism to promote their own economic, financial, or political advantage, weakening us in the face of danger by trying to set our own people to fighting amongst themselves. We must combat them as we would the plague. We cannot afford to face the future as a disunited people.
Our guest, Robert Dalek, is the biographer of John Kennedy's unfinished life and of Lyndon Johnson, subtitled The Flawed Giant. With a master's touch and timing, Dalek is out this winter with a single giant volume on FDR, elected four times through the Great Depression and World War II. I asked Bob Dalek, in the state of our union in 2018, the state of our minds, is there not a near palpable longing for the buoyancy in that voice of FDR's?
Well, you know, Roosevelt passed through a time which is not entirely unlike what we're going through now. There was a terrible sense of crisis in the country in 1932 when he got elected, and 25% unemployment. A million people were riding the rails across the country in search of work. There was a sense of desperation. And you know, what people tend to forget now is that there was a competition with fascism in Italy, Nazism in Germany, communism in Russia. So could this American capitalist system survive? Could it inject enough hope into the populace to recover from this awful economic downturn? So Roosevelt carried on in an extraordinary way. And what we can never forget is that this was a man, when he was 39 years old, suffered infantile paralysis, and he never walked again. He was immobilized. His presence in the White House gave the country hope that the way he had recovered from his serious illness, the country now could recover from this desperate economic collapse. And at the same time, he was masterful at offering the kind of commentary on the radio, and of course, these famous fireside chats. When he spoke, he captured the public's imagination, and it was as if he was sitting in your living room with you, assuring you that things were going to be better, things would be okay. And proof of this to me is the fact that after he died, somebody stopped Mrs. Roosevelt on the street and said to her, "I miss the way your husband used to speak to me about my government." Or the man who stood by the railway track after Roosevelt died and the body was being transported from Warm Springs to Hyde Park, and he was sobbing, and somebody said to him, "Did you know the president?" And he said, "No, but he knew me." So Roosevelt was a, might I say, a shot in the arm. He gave the country hope. And the fact, though, is that the New Deal didn't end the Depression. It was, of course, industrial mobilization for World War II, which did that. But the New Deal did something more important, I think, in the long run, which was to humanize the American capitalist system. And he put into place the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which insures bank accounts, unemployment insurance, Social Security, the Rural Electrification Administration, the National Youth Administration, all those alphabet agencies, the CCC and the WPA and the PWA. They turned the federal government into a kind of rescue agency that helped billions of people.
There's another point you make early on in the book, which is first that he wasn't trying to rebuild an economic system explicitly. He was trying to rebuild faith in the institutions of American life, especially government. But yes, the faith business, he had almost a civil religion of inspiration. And for a non-religious man, it was an extraordinary maneuver. He spoke at his first inauguration, I think, of a national consecration.
That's right.
I wonder, could anybody get away with that today? Or do we need
it? Well, we do need it. And one thing I would give to Mr. Trump is that, like Roosevelt and Kennedy and Reagan later, he mastered this modern media design. Roosevelt used radio. Kennedy and Reagan used television. Now Trump has used, he became a celebrity TV star, and also with this tweeting. But what's different about Trump, of course, is that he's never had majority support. He lost the popular vote by 2.8 million. Roosevelt, of course, won a huge landslide when he ran a second time in 1936. And while his next two elections were significantly closer, they never came close to beating him. And so he was really a masterful politician who used the mass media of radio at the time as a tool to reach out and connect himself in very effective ways to the public.
I was fascinated. I had forgotten that radio in the 30s was the liberal medium up against the conservative power of newspaper owners. I'd forgotten that.
You know, what's also interesting, of course, is that Roosevelt held these press conferences 2-3 times a week. Amazing. Mm. And the reporters loved him because he would sit at his desk, they'd crowd around the Oval Office, and he'd say to them, "Well, boys, there's nothing new today." And then he'd say, "But off the record." And then he'd take them in to some kind of confidence. And they loved him. Now, the newspaper publishers, as you were just saying, they were conservative. And they despised him. They opposed him. But Roosevelt, because the Federal Communications Commission was created during that New Deal, and it served liberal purposes, and they gave radio station licenses to people who would be sympathetic to Roosevelt and the New Deal. And, of course, in Texas, in Austin in particular, it was Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird Johnson who got the license for that radio station.
Right.
And, of course, he was a protege of Roosevelt's.
Of course, the deep question inside this dyspeptic nation then and today, in a way, is fascism and the reality of it. Roosevelt comes to power at the same time as Hitler. Mussolini is already there. Soviet Union is there. And Huey Long is remembered saying, of course we'll have fascism in this country and we'll call it democracy.
Yes.
Staring it down. I mean, Roosevelt was staring at the gravest sort of danger. We speak of this as a sort of Weimar moment in America. But what's the reality in the historian's view?
Well, I think the reality is that America is always being tested. Democracy in the country is always under attack in one form or another. And Roosevelt understood that. He said, the two most dangerous men in America are Huey Long and Douglas MacArthur, the general, you see, because he feared that the man on a white horse might succeed and take power in the country. So there was a kind of anxiety about the stability of the country's democratic institutions. And, of course, there were some who began comparing Roosevelt to Mussolini and Hitler and saying he wanted to be an American Hitler, you see, which he had, of course, no intention of doing. And he was the great defender of democracy. And, of course, as it turned out, a defender on the world scene along with Winston Churchill. So I mean, it was an extraordinary 12 years. But there are lessons for us
That.
To remember that you can have effective leadership. In fact, so many people have forgotten about the man and his achievements, his effectiveness. And I wanted people to recall that there could be a brilliantly effective democratic leader with a small d.
On the brink, so to speak. Yeah, you know, then and now, the symptoms of oligarchy were all out there. Roosevelt talked about economic royalists. We talk about Wall Street. He addressed it in the first famous New Deal speech as a promise to lead a crusade to restore America to its own people, which sounds very, very 2016, 2017, 2018. What do we learn from what he did?
Well, I think the best phrase that captures that was the one he used in 1936 when he said, better a government that lives in a spirit of charity than one frozen in the ice of its own indifference. And the idea was, people need to have regard for the government, you see. And we know whenever there is a crisis, a hurricane, a tornado, or whatever it may be, they turn to the federal government to provide relief, support. But somehow people seem to lose connection to that. And they live with this proposition that the government is not supportive, it's not helpful. My feeling is we're back in another gilded age, that people are blinded by this wealth and the corruption that goes with it that we saw in those late 19th century decades.
Bob Dalek, what would Franklin Roosevelt make of our own State of the Union? I wonder sometimes if he wouldn't speak very, very sharply to us. You know, get busy. You brought a lot of this on yourselves. Think more clearly.
Yep.
Remember some fundamental ideas. I mean, a real woodshed talk.
Well, he would have led a kind of progressive crusade in the way Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson led progressive crusade at the start of the 20th century when they were responding to that gilded age when there had been so much corruption in government and dislocations in the economy with the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of these robber barons, as they were called. And, you know, somebody was at this Davos conference that's been taking place in Switzerland this January, and they came back from it and said, at this Davos conference, the billionaires are telling the millionaires what the middle class is thinking. See? And I think it speaks volumes about how the super wealthy have a kind of dominance in society once again, the way they did in the 1920s. So we need to get back to some of that. We need a person who reflects the larger feelings in the country. It'll happen again. I'm confident it'll happen again because there's such a rich history of this in the past. And my friend Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said about the cycles of American history, We go through these periods, and then the next day we look in the mirror and ask ourselves, how could we have done that, you see? And I think that's what will happen with this Trump presidency, too. You know, when Richard Nixon was ousted from the White House, forced to resign, he still had 25% approval from people in the country. So
The base,
right.
Any last word on the state of our union? Is there one word? Is there one Dalek word?
Struggling, bumbling along. It's at the moment not in the best of shape.
Robert Dalek's new book is Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. Coming up, the reporter Tom Ricks, late of the Washington Post, one of those rare pros who left Washington at the height of his powers because the Iraq War had broken his heart and Washington felt more like Babylon, no longer my city. This is Open Source. Our guest, Thomas Ricks, did the almost unthinkable. He was in on two Pulitzer Prizes for war coverage at the Washington Post. Then he wrote the bestseller Fiasco about the war in Iraq, and he never got embedded in the operations or the thinking of the Pentagon, or the city, for that matter. After Iraq, Tom Ricks moved out to an island off Maine before the Trump train crash began, he said, because he could feel it coming.
I came back to Washington, and I found increasingly I didn't enjoy it as much as I used to the game of Washington, the hurly-burly, the daily pageant, the tragedy and the comedy. And I decided to become a full-time book writer and answer the questions I had in my head.
A man coming back to Washington from Maine is almost coming from Mars. First impressions, what does one see with eyes refreshed by living on a Maine island?
The first thing I see is how much I miss Maine. The water, Penobscot Bay, the sky, the trees, the islands, the animals. The second thing I see is a city of hardworking people, politicians, Capitol Hill staffers, bureaucrats, a city that seems almost entirely of denial. And that's not just of Trump, though I think it's hugely under Trump, is people pretending that this is normal. For me, it goes back to the Iraq War and to 9/11. I think the whole country panicked after 9/11. The federal government led the panic. And we've never really confronted the enormous mistake this country made in going into Iraq. Even now, people understand that by invading Iraq, we basically turned Iraq over to Iran. And Iran is now the dominant power in the Middle East. And Iran has run a war that now extends Iranian power from Western Afghanistan, I mean, through Iran, of course, through Iraq, into Syria and into Lebanon. So Iran now is the dominant Middle Eastern power from the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush. And we've never really confronted our role in understanding all that. So I found Washington is a city that works effectively, but most effectively in denial of reality.
Can I just observe from the provinces, Tom, that I think an awful lot of people who follow the news realize this and wonder why the main organs of our media don't, why the city of Washington doesn't, the public conversation in general, and this week in the State of the Union time too, I think will be, you know, speaking another language. Plain people know otherwise.
I have a theory on this. My theory is the media wants to be professional. They want to be fair. They want to be objective. And they're operating under a president right now who doesn't want to be fair, doesn't want to be professional, doesn't want to be objective, they keep on pretending that they can operate the same old way. And it's because they're trying to be professional and be normal while dealing with an aberrant, abnormal president who I think is probably a psychotic. He has a personality built on fear. It is raw, naked, stupid fear. And it makes me wonder what happened to him as a child, what his father did to him, that has left this guy in just a paranoid, narcissistic crouch lashing out at the world.
Come back to your farewell to Washington, Tom. You wrote in a remarkable piece, the center of it was the Iraq War, and you called it the most important event of our time. Still unrepented, still undigested in lots of ways. And the people who egged it on, especially in the media, are still in office. They have their columns.
Everybody makes mistakes. But being for the Iraq War was a huge mistake. And yeah, I do wonder why there hasn't been more sober reflection among journalists about it. Look, we're all human. We're all deeply flawed people.
I didn't realize, Tom Ricks, how sophisticated, broad, widely traveled man you were before journalism, so to speak. And yet you come to Washington and you behaved in Washington like a kind of innocent, which you were. In Washington, in your rather remarkable writing career, where did you go for the truth? Not the post lead, but the heart of the matter that might last.
I thought you always had to have the courage to believe your own perceptions, which is one reason I like Orwell so much. Orwell insists that the beginning of freedom is the right to believe what you see and to count on your fingers and say 2 fingers plus 2 fingers makes 4 fingers. And remember, in 1984, he has his hero, Winston. Winston is tortured until he says, okay, I'll say 2 plus 2 equals 5. Mm-hmm. And his torturer says, no, you can't just say it. You have to believe it. And they keep on torturing him. And he finally says, you tell me what it is and I will believe it. And I always thought it was a fairly simple formula in Washington to believe your own perceptions. I realize if something doesn't sound right to me, I've been around the block, I'm pretty smart, I'd say, I don't understand this. Why is that? The ability to say, I don't understand, or what's going on here, is the beginning of wisdom in Washington. A lot of people want to pretend they're so sophisticated they get it, they understand it. So I basically just called it like I saw it. I actually found it fairly simple as long as you didn't mind people not liking you. I remember once I ran into David Halberstam, the great Vietnam correspondent for the New York Times.
How we miss him.
We were just chatting. I said, let me ask you. I said, I'm finding life a little bit hard these days. I mean, I got Rumsfeld denouncing me in press conferences. I've got people making trouble for me. I've got Bill O'Reilly denouncing me on Fox News as a traitor because I wrote that the Iraq War likely would last past the summer of 2003. And he looked at me kind of with a wince and he said, Tom, you are showing officials to be acting foolishly. They're not going to thank you for that. Suck it up. And it was such great advice. Tom, they're not going to thank you for showing that they're acting foolishly. Suck it up. I said, yep, you know, that's good advice. Just do your job and go to sleep with good conscience.
The promotional slogans of the Post and the Times get bolder and bolder. Democracy dies in darkness, the Post says, and the Times says, truth has a voice. The reader wonders.
Well, the Times slogan at least had the advantage of being more or less true, even as kind of irrelevant, who cares if it has a voice, and it certainly always isn't going to be the New York Times that has the truth. I hate the Post slogan, by contrast. Democracy dies in darkness. First of all, it's not true. If you look at how democracies fall apart, it's in the open. It's in the public curtailment of rights. It's in the erosion of freedom of speech. It's in people self-censoring when they are acting in a public manner. Democracy dies in the open, first of all. Second of all, it's a real downer as a slogan. It's about darkness. I don't want to see darkness on the front page of the newspaper. I want illumination and light.
Which brings us to Orwell. You've written a strong book on Churchill and Orwell, Tom Ricks. It fascinates me. The wise people in our world who say at the end of long reading lives, it was all about Orwell. Orwell got it. And Camus, too, across the channel. But there's so much of it, from Wigan Pier to 1984 and Animal Farm and all those essays. But what's the heart of George Orwell for you?
The heart of Orwell for me, my favorite book by Orwell, is not one of his more famous ones. It's Homage to Catalonia.
Yes, about the Spanish Civil War, of course.
Partly because I'm an old war correspondent. He's just some of the best things ever written about war. He really captures what a front line feels like. I actually, reading Orwell, would kind of crib from him a little bit as I was trying to cover wars in Iraq and Somalia and stuff.
Hmm.
How he noticed things, to see it through his eyes. If Orwell were here, how would he write about this? And the honesty about, you know, the boredom, how nothing much ever happened until something happened and then too much happened. I think Orwell, because of his willingness to perceive what was in front of him, and he said that was the most difficult thing, to see what is in front of your eyes. It's a model for me of journalism. Listen to the rhetoric, listen to what people are saying, and then go out and compare it to the reality. But be prepared to say, what I see here is not what the officials are telling me.
I just wanted to nominate an essay he wrote, a long essay. It was a small book called The Lion and the Unicorn in 1941, when war was clearly coming. But it was an amazing exercise in, oh, by the way, who are we English? And what are we like? And what's good, what's bad, what's working, what's not? And he talked about the gentleness of the English civilization, perhaps its most marked characteristic. But he said, the English are inveterate gamblers. They drink as much beer as their wages will permit. They're devoted to bawdy jokes. They use probably the foulest language in the world, and on, affectionate details. But it had a point, too. He said, a family with the wrong members in control, that perhaps is as near as one can come to describing England in a phrase. He said, one of the dominant facts in English life during the past three quarters of a century has been the decay of ability in the ruling class. He was a socialist, of course, and he thought, I mean, he was a man from Eton and Oxbridge, but he felt all that class structure had to come down before they could win a war, or what they had to do if they won the war. But time after time, in our world today, I think, who could write that sort of profile of the American people?
I'm really struck by the post-9/11 generation of veterans. And I have this column that I do called The Long March for a website, Task and Purpose. And in it, I've put together a group I call the Council of Former Enlisted, which is former soldiers, and no officers allowed, just enlisted, discussing the military and security policy and so on, but also their perceptions of America, of the world. And they're a fascinating generation to me, and I think some very honest voices. A couple of things that strike me about the post-9/11 veterans. One is they don't like the police. They see the police in this country have kind of militarized over the last 15 years. And the police are now using the tactics on American citizens that these soldiers used in Iraq. And they don't like that. Another thing is they distrust the government enormously. They're rather affectionate toward the military. Generally, you know, some good things, some bad things, but I'm happy I did it, you know. And it's really striking to me because we now have a generation of people coming up in this country. Basically, anybody who is 22, 23 years or younger, they have no memory of what this country was like before 9/11, before the national panic, before the TSA could basically say anything they want to you when you're trying to get on an airplane or you can't get on the airplane. I think before police became militarized, this is not the way this country used to operate, at least with white people. I think black people are very familiar with that sort of treatment.
Yes.
But the police, I think, have grown very arrogant in this country in the last 15 years, as have Border Patrol, immigration police. There's really a sense that we make the rules now and you better hop to it or you might suffer some consequences.
Mm. Speak of a few other things you see that right in front of our eyes, but we don't talk about it.
I think the biggest single thing that's going on in this country that people are not seeing is we now live in an oligarchy. That is to say, a country run by the rich, for the rich, and of the rich. You and I have votes, but they're much less important than campaign donations, campaign money. It puzzles me that it's all around us, but people don't see it. You may see it, I may see it, but it is not part of the public conversation. You don't see it on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, or in the New Yorker, saying this is the structure of our country.
This brings us back to Orwell, who asked in that same essay, 1941, is England a genuine democracy? No, not even a reader of the Daily Telegraph could quite swallow that, he wrote. England is the most class-ridden country under the sun. It is a land of snobbery and privilege, ruled largely by the old and the silly. A foreign observer, he wrote, sees the huge inequality of wealth, the unfair electoral system, the governing class control over the press, the radio, and education, and concludes that democracy is simply a polite name for dictatorship. That's harsh, but it's now a sort of classic.
Well, he was right. The British political deal was the rest of the country will defer to the aristocracy as long as the aristocracy runs the country sensibly. The problem that Orwell faced was the British aristocracy basically had blown it in the 1930s. They were comfortable with fascism, and a lot of people thought that the world was going to come down to a decision between fascism and communism, and the British aristocracy, by and large, went with fascism to the point at which they were willing to live with Hitler.
Hmm.
I'm not a believer in the great man theory of history, but it is sometimes true that a single person can make a huge difference. And Churchill made a huge difference in the spring of 1940 when Churchill had the fate of the world more or less in his hands. And he took Britain away from the aristocracy and said, you've blown it. And at one point, he actually looks up to see, find out who were the pilots flying in the Battle of Britain and keeping the Germans from invading. And he's amazed to realize that it's the middle-class kids. It is not the elites from Eton and Harrow, the schools that the aristocracy went to, that these are the sons of small-town lawyers and bankers and even clerks. And he says they have saved this country and now they have the right to run it. And that's Churchill. So Churchill and Orwell both agree the aristocracy blew it.
Mm. What's the caution to us here?
I don't know why I immediately thought of Bob Dylan's line, don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters. I think the lesson is think for yourself, observe the facts for yourself. If there's one thing I could ask every American to read, it would be Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, which is so much in the tradition of Orwell, where he says the fact of the matter is that Birmingham is the most segregated city in America. The fact of the matter is that Negroes who stand up for their rights are met here with violence, not only from citizens, but from the police. And the fact of the matter is that all we are asking is the federal government to give us the rights the federal government says we have, which is the right to vote, the right to free speech. We are being denied these rights. And it's simply about the facts of the matter. Don't listen to Donald Trump and believe him. Don't listen to politicians and believe them. Believe the facts of your life. Look around you. Bad things are happening out there that the president pays no attention to. Instead, we get all these diversions, people blaming things on immigrants. Immigrants are the best thing that happened to this country. Another thing on the island I live on is there's a heating fund because Maine is cold for many months. And there are people who cannot afford to keep their house warm, who may have to make decisions between food and heat. And so the church I go to has a heating fund run by the minister. And she was talking about this one day. She said, you know, people say, how do you know they really need the money? And they're shocked when I say, we don't try to ask them if they need the money. If they come and ask for it, these are proud people. If they come and ask for it, we give them the money. We do not sit in judgment of them. We stand in awe of the burdens they carry. If there's one thing I could say to Washington, everybody in Washington, not just Trump, not just the Republicans, stand in awe of the burdens everybody out there is carrying. And I don't think that's understood these days.
Tom Ricks writes a daily column on military matters titled The Long March on the website Task and Purpose. His last book was Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. Thank you, Tom Ricks. Thanks also to Robert Dalek, Vanessa Williamson, and the good people near the subway stops in Kendall, Mattapan, and Maverick Squares. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer, with help from Paul Kalo. Felipe Paloma is our driver. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. Radio Open Source is an independent public radio show that relies on your support. Join our Patreon community and you'll get exclusive interviews, special events, and podcasts. Sign up at patreon.com/radioopensource.